Thank you for listening to this Podcast One Sportsnet production, available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Welcome to Real Jam Radio. I'm Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Jonathan Charks of Real GM and many other outlets. He is one of my absolute favorite writers. He's been a guest on the show numerous times before, and we started out talking about the Sixers. He wrote an interesting piece about Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens Noel, talked about where the league is going and connected that with various players, including Karl-Anthony Towns and Kristaps Porzingis. Also talk about college. He's been very into that this year and the players who he thinks are going to translate and things like that. And the conversation runs about 50 minutes. I really enjoyed it, and I hope you will too. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Doing well. I figure the best place to start, of course, we'll probably cover a lot of ground, is you wrote a really interesting piece, actually kind of a couple of them, about how you see the Sixers and Jahlil Okafor. I guess I'll give you the first word on it. Just, you want to summarize what your kind of feelings on Okafor and his fit with the Sixers?
I guess my basic thing with him is I look at Okafor, I see a super advanced offensive prospect with huge holes on defense. And that wouldn't necessarily be a big issue, except he's a center. And if you look around the league, most teams with bad defensive centers are bad teams. Like, generally, that's a defensive position. And you're playing a guy who does not protect the rim, does not move his feet, does not know how to call out coverages, and cannot be the quarterback of your defense, you're going to be a bad team. And the reason most teams have centers is because they want to play good defense. Otherwise, they play five small guys and score a lot of points. Somebody with Jahlil is like, as good as he is on offense, until he's good at defense, it's going to put a pretty low ceiling on his team. And my concern with him is that it's going to take him, realistically, an awfully long time to get good at defense. Like, I look at big men with his kind of skill set and like athletic ability. They have to really think the game at a high level. They have to know the game really well, know personnel. You're looking 3-5 years at the earliest, I think, before you can become even an average defender. And that's tough. What makes it even worse is the team around him is so young, they can't really keep their men in front of them to begin with. So they have to have a guy who protects the rim instead of makes it even worse.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I think that it is challenging but not impossible to build a defense without having a center. However, what it requires from everybody else is, both from a coaching standpoint and from a personnel standpoint, incredibly hard to do. Boston, I think, has done a pretty good job, and Charlotte, of course, with Clifford has done it. But again, it's a massive undertaking, and as is true with any NBA player with a flaw, you have to decide whether the positives they bring are worth that. And as you said, the calculus for him at center is completely different than anywhere else. The closest parallel I can draw is a point guard who's really gifted defensively that can't run an offense.
Yeah, or can't shoot. Same kind of basic idea.
Yeah, same basic idea. And something you talked about in one of the pieces, I believe it was for your site, was about how Okafor is negatively impacting what we're seeing from Nerlens Noel, because the two of them together, we don't get to see Noel really reach towards the maximum of his potential.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the main thing, is with centers, you got to pick one or the other and build around them. But playing with two centers in the modern NBA is almost impossible, unless one of them is like Karl Towns. And you have Towns and Gorgui Dieng. But realistically, the things Nerlens does requires being at the front of the rim. And so do the things that Jahlil does well. And so you're going to have to pick one or the other. And that's before we get into Joel Embiid, which is a whole different can of worms, obviously.
And with Noel, I think some people kind of can confuse a couple of different aspects. And one is that because he is physically capable of, I would say, of defending fours, that doesn't mean that he should do it. You know, his best position is the five either way.
Yeah, for sure. Like, the strength of his game is protecting the rim. So because he can do something else, but it takes the strength of his game, then what's the point of even having him out there? Like, you're not maximizing his ability at all.
And offensively, I think that he derives almost all of his value from playing the five, because he doesn't really stretch the floor, and because his quickness advantage on fives, and we're seeing this around the league a little bit now, and you wrote an interesting piece we'll get into a little bit later about with the idea of Henry Ellenson and guys like that, is that there are certain competitive advantages that those kind of tweener guys only really get one direction, that they don't get the other way.
Yeah, to me it seems like the way the league is going is, like, if you have the speed advantage, you have the advantage. So you want to play guys down as much as possible. And so with Noel, he's playing the four. He's playing small, fast guys. And he has to post them up. And I don't think I'm breaking any news here when I'm saying if you're posting them Nerlens Noel 15 times a game, it's not necessarily a way to succeed in the modern NBA.
And I think that's true more broadly as well, that, you know, the advantages or disadvantages that you get. I was struck last night, I was watching the Warriors and the Heat play, and the Warriors pretty much, other than a little bit towards the very end, refused to slide down against Hassan Whiteside. And Nate Duncan and I talked about it last night, but Hassan Whiteside is not particularly well suited to taking advantage of that kind of physical advantage on somebody else. He can do other things, but he's not a post-up guy. He can't pass. And so when you don't have to make that choice, then that's when you try to go small.
Yeah. I haven't watched the Heat since Bosch has been injured, so this is purely me speculating. But I've been super curious to see if you move Dang to the four and you play really fast around the five, whether that will actually make them a more interesting team. As I think all around the league, you're seeing that with Mo Harkless going from the three to the four. I think that makes them a much more interesting team. It's all about getting speed all over every position before you can.
And what I've been thinking about, and I haven't written it yet, but I've been trying to put it together, is that the more prevalent that is, then the more acceptable it is everywhere else, because then you start making the choice. Basically, my theory on that with the three spot and the four is that I think eventually we're just going to see a lot more straight small forwards play the power forward position, because power forwards, generally speaking, don't have the game to exploit that size mismatch.
Yeah, and if they did, then we'll throw my five on you, if that comes to worst case scenario. So it's really hard to do it. I remember reading it. What really crystallized things for me was, one, watching that Grizzlies-Warriors series last year when Harry Barnes really shut down. I wouldn't say shut down, but he guarded Zeebo well enough. And I was reading a profile, and then your boy Ron Adams, he says, I see the league being where there's a lot of Harrison Barnes out there. And I was like, that's exactly right. Threes playing fours, that's the way the league is going.
I agree, and that ties into a guy that you've talked about recently, which is Jaylen Brown. And he's one of the few guys in college that I've actually seen in person because I live nearby. And I think that he's kind of towing a couple lines. I think in the olden days, you know, like in the 80s or whatever, he would have been a straight three, been a straight small forward. And now he can be a four. He doesn't really have the offensive game for it, but I think defensively there's a place for him in the league.
Oh, yeah. If he's playing the four, then you boom, switch pick and roll like that. And I think you're seeing with the Warriors, I think the league is realizing now that going big against Golden State is not going to work. That was the story of last year's playoffs. Well, let's pound Draymond inside. Let's be bigger, slow tempo. That's just not going to work. You got to put a wing on Draymond, you switch pick and rolls, and you run it from there. Because otherwise, anything else, you can't guard pick and roll at all, I don't think. You can't trap Steph, can't get Wonder. You just got to switch it. And a really fast player at the four can do that. And I think that's really where Jaylen has value. He's playing in a three, as he's been saying. Like, he can't shoot that well. He's not a great ball handler or passer and a great scorer. If you really have value at the next level, I think he has to be a four.
When fours are banging less, when they're playing less back to the basket, and also tactically, I think, and this I feel is one of the bigger long-term legacies of the Warriors, is that you can, if that's what you're conceding, you can mitigate that, I think, a lot better than you used to be able to with trapping, with switching, with movement and things like that. So if that's the worst case scenario, it's not that bad.
Yeah, yeah.
So one of the I've also been thinking about with Draymond is that, well, of course, the general concepts that we've been talking about are valid and are will eventually become a lot more prevalent than they are now. It does require special personnel, and there aren't many people who can do what Draymond does either offensively or defensively. And what I'm wondering about is how awkward that evolution is going to be with the people who aren't so good, like Towns and maybe Porzingis and Miles Turner, who to make that transition. You know, when people try to do it with some other 6'8" guys, that might not make it work. We might see some really bad outcomes, but I feel like even then, that's kind of worth it for where this is going.
I mean, I think it's like, you know, you use the old metaphor, just the evolution of the game in real time. You'll just see what the NBA wants, they'll start selecting for players, and that will trickle down to AAU level. Like, I'm working on a thing right now with Draymond, because I feel like 10 years ago, you look at Draymond and say, well, he's not big enough to be a four, he's not a three, he's one of those combo forwards. He's Antonio Gates, he's Tony Gonzalez, he's Jimmy Graham. Like, let him be an NFL tight end. Now, all those kind of players, they got to place the NBA again. You're 6'6", 6'7", 240 pounds, really skilled guy, not necessarily a great shot blocker, necessarily a great shooter. And that makes sense for him now. And the league starts going, hey, don't go play NFL. You can play in the NBA. We're looking for guys like this. And that just trickles down from there.
Like the Julius Peppers of the world. Another
exactly,
guy.
Exactly, yeah.
Gonna take a quick break so I can tell you about the inaugural sponsor of Real Jam Radio Podcast, and I'm thrilled that it is SeatGeek. As some of you know, but most of you don't, I was actually a ticket broker buying and selling tickets and, of course, going to a lot of events all around North America earlier in this decade. And so I've been around the business a lot, and I'm thrilled to have SeatGeek as sponsor because it is my go-to for buying and selling tickets. There are a lot of reasons for it for me. One of them is aggregation. So you know that when you're buying a ticket that it combines all of the other sites that are out there. So you know that you have everything available. Also, since their prices are all in, you can compare apples to apples instead of being hit with fees after the fact, which can be pretty frustrating. And also, they have deal score, so you can tell whether the tickets that you're buying or the tickets that you're selling. You can see if they think it's a good deal. And my personal instinct is that that will make for sellers to be a little bit more aggressive, because if they see their stuff as a bad score, it's probably not going to sell. For Real Jam Radio listeners, you can get a $20 rebate on your first SeatGeek purchase. What you have to do is you have to download the free SeatGeek app. It's a wonderful app. Then you go to the settings tab, and one of the things there is add a promo code. The promo code is REALGM, REALGM, all capitals. You'll know it because it's the name of the podcast. And then when you make your first purchase, SeatGeek will send you $20. So not only do you get to experience a great product, you also get to get $20 off your first purchase. So I strongly encourage you to do that, and we'll get back to my conversation with Jonathan Charks. I also think, though, that one of the key attributes of those players is intelligence. And if that becomes something that is selected for at a higher level, I think that would be a great thing in a lot of different ways. If we're encouraging that in professionals, then, again, that's going to filter down to AAU, too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the game changes pretty fast, and kids pick up on it really quickly. They all want to be rich. They want to make money. You know, same as anything else.
I talked probably a couple months ago with Audie Joseph, who's my editor at the Sporting News, when he was on this podcast, about my idea that I think that we should, as a country, I guess would be the right way to put it, we should focus more on developing guard skills in everybody, because it seems pretty apparent to me that at any really level, we're not particularly good at training big men for big men skills. And so, except for things like screening, which I think would be great if almost everybody could do, I think that if we can get people to a more comfortable base in terms of dribbling and passing, and I think there are more coaches in the youth levels that can teach that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the story of the league for the last 15 or so years. Just the big man. I'm from Dallas. When I was going to play basketball, all the big men wanted to shoot jumpers like Dirk. And that's Hasty LaMarcus, Chris Bosh, all those kind of guys. And so that's been going on for a while now. The bigs want to play like guards. In the AAU game, you're not going to see much post-up play to begin with, which, kind of going back to Jahlil, I think is one of the low-key problems in Philly. As I was watching against the Mavs, Jahlil's posting up. The other four guys don't have a clue what to do. They don't know about cutting off the ball. They don't know about reposting. They don't know any of that. They're just running around crazy people. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to use a big man at all.
And that's a really good point, because I think we sometimes lose sight of how involved the other four guys have to be on a post-up, because we don't see that as much anymore as we should.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's a very complicated system of events that has to go down. Like, I think people think post-up, oh, we'll just throw the ball outside, we'll stand on the perimeter. But no, you got to get movement first, you got to repost them, got to get them to seal, got to get a post-entry pass. My goodness, how many guys know post-entry pass these days? Probably half a dozen.
Yeah, that's one of Rondo's huge benefits, is that he's one of the few guys that can do a lot of those passes, and so DeMarcus Cousins can get the ball in better spots.
Well, you know, as a Dallas guy, I won't talk about Rondo too much. He had quite a run here.
But, you know, he has certain merits, and I think that Sacramento is a better place for those than Dallas, considering DeMarcus Cousins, you know, he's more valuable for that than he was playing with Dirk or any of the other bigs that Dallas has.
Well, I think with him, it was just him and Monte. That was like oil and water, those two guys playing together. That was just walking into it. That was just a suicide mission to jump.
We talked about the idea. I think both of us are less enamored with the idea of a post-up true center. But I still see a value in posting up. I just think it should come from the smaller positions. You can think about somebody like Sean Livingston, who I think is really good at it. Shabazz Muhammad does a pretty good job. Wiggins at moments does it. And so the idea that I've been running around is the idea of going four out, but having the guy that's in being somebody who is not the center.
Yeah, basically inverting your offense. Yeah, I mean, that's like, I think that goes back to your saying about versatility. In a way, the way players have to be taught now is you've got to do everything. The game is calling for complete basketball players. You have a hole in your game that's going to be exposed. You want to be the best you can be good at everything. Learn how to dribble, learn how to pass, learn how to shoot, learn how to post up. And it's all going to matter. Like, that's why I like Karl Towns so much, because he can do everything really well, and that's really the way the game is going right now.
And as we talk about the idea of where the game is going and, you know, these different things, it is incredibly important to note that any sort of arc or development or thing like that can be changed, or the rules don't apply to the truly special. You know, if you can reach that level where you can get your shot, where you can be a rim protector, whatever it is that you do really well, if you can do that in spite of the movements that are going the other way, then you can still do that. And I think what is so impressive is that we have this group of at least three big men in this rookie class, and you could expand it if you really wanted to, where you don't have to make those sacrifices. So when we talk about the way the league is going, doesn't matter. It fits them already.
I mean, the guy I really want to see more of is Jokic. I haven't watched him a ton. He's coming to Dallas on Friday. He's coming to Dallas tomorrow night, actually. Have you watched much of him? Like, he looks really good from the few times I've seen him play.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what you think of him, because he, offensively, he does a lot of what you want. He is a really good passer. I haven't watched, you know, a ton. I've really liked what I've seen, but I haven't seen a ton. But he doesn't do the same things in terms of the defensive value that we were talking about with Towns, and ideally with Turner as well, where, you know, he can protect the rim, he can do all that stuff. I don't trust him on that yet. That isn't to say, you know, he's 21 years old. He can get there. He just isn't there yet. And there aren't many 20, 21-year-olds who are there in the first place, so I'm not really sure we should put that. But when he's not, I don't think of him as the most athletic guy in the world. Those are the ones that I generally give the credence to. You know, like Tyson Chandler didn't come into the league as a great defender. He was more of a shot blocker than a defender, and he developed that. But it's a lot harder to get to that place. Like, I guess Marc Gasol did. It's harder to get there from where he was, but it's still possible.
And I think that's what people always say, like, you've got to wait a long time on big men. Because I've always thought, like, playing interior defense is the hardest thing to learn in the NBA. Because it just takes such a mental, I mean, it's physical, obviously, too, but it's a mental challenge. Like, you're the quarterback of the defense.
And a lot of it also comes from experience, that there are things that you just will never have seen before you play in an NBA game, unless you're maybe at the highest levels of Europe.
Yes, that, and it's just knowing personnel around the league. It's knowing, well, how this guy likes to drive the ball. What spots this guy wants to go to. And that just comes from repetition, from playing them 10, 12 times over 4 or 5 years period of time.
And that also might explain why you see this pattern of physically gifted big men hit their defensive prime a lot later. So a guy like Bogut was a number one pick for a reason. It wasn't primarily because of his defense. He became a great defender kind of after his offensive game waned. Though, of course, he's a different guy for that, because the reason his offensive game fell off is because of injury.
Yeah, and I think, as you were saying, Gasol is a perfect example. I remember when I first saw him, I was like, wow, this guy isn't going to be a regular defensive player. He's so slow, but he just thought the game was big enough, and he produced himself really well when defensive player in the year, which I would have never thought possible, I can't believe.
And a lot of that is also communication, and communication takes time. It takes time to really know where to be and to do that. And also, I don't know this for sure, but it feels like having a good mentor and really getting in best practices for that kind of thing is good, because you don't really get trained on that beforehand. And that's one of the benefits that I see of Karl Anthony Towns spending at least the first year of his career, but probably the first two with Kevin Garnett.
Yeah, I remember, I think Perkins always said that when he was still a pretty good player. He would always credit Kevin Garnett for teaching him how to be the quarterback of the defense.
I wonder, I just don't know if you need to have those players on roster to really be those mentors, or if you can just say, like, a Jason Collins or somebody like that, if you can have them on your coaching staff and they can do basically the same thing.
I would assume that a lot of it, though, is seeing through watching them do it in person, execute it themselves. Because they can say, do whatever, but it's watch them execute it on the court.
And in practice, too.
Helpful.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm just speculating. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder, because otherwise you're just going to always have this really small group of teachers if they can't do it as coaching staff, because you have to still be at least a little bit relevant as a player to be in that kind of a capacity.
And I mean, I think that's why you see so many big men hang around so long on back ends of rosters, precisely those kind of reasons.
And that gets into something, I've talked about it before with the Sixers, that does bother me, is that you can't necessarily see all 15 of your roster spots. I also think they should expand that, but all 15 of your roster spots going to just kind of upside plays, because part of what you need to do is skill development and having guys, not only the whole veteran showing them the ropes in terms of being a pro and all that. I think that is incredibly valuable, but also just the institutional knowledge that you get and that can resonate a lot better from an active player than anybody else.
Yeah, and I think in general, too, like, we look at teams amassing draft picks. I do think there's a diminishing marginal return the more young guys you've got. Because like you see with Philly, like we're talking about Okafor and Noel, to get the most out of their games, you got to put six players around them. So if you have two or three guys whose games don't fit well together, they're never going to reach their ceiling as players with how you're developing them. So you have to commit to one or two, which is why you can only have so many top five picks on your roster or top 10 picks. I think you saw Orlando at the deadline with Tobias Harris. They liked him as a player, but they had Aaron Gordon behind him, so they had to make a decision, and he was gone for pretty much nothing. So all said and done, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's only so much you can do with so many young players at any one time.
Yeah, I think that's true to a point. Obviously, I think if you can get the veteran aspect, the ideal, and this doesn't happen as much now, and we'll see where it goes, is to have a veteran guy who can do that, let's say in their, maybe a little bit more in their early 30s as opposed to their mid-30s, who is still a functional player so that you're not, quote-unquote, sacrificing a roster spot. But you are right that you can reach this point of diminishing returns. I think Minnesota has been there at a couple different points, and also, with the way that rosters are limited and constructed now, you can look at a team like Boston, where they have a series of interesting, you know, kind of lottery tickets, if you will, with Rozier and RJ Hunter and James Young and Jordan Mickey, who I know you really like. And, you know, that they're probably going to add a couple more to that mix. Like, if you can't get much to consolidate them, then you're going to have to make some tough decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think of my man Bruno Caboclo in Toronto. I mean, how is he ever going to get any minutes there? It doesn't seem anyway.
And the NBA, I personally feel they play too many games, and so that also means when you have an 82-game season and you have it under the calendar limits that we have, they don't get to practice as much as we... It's not as much that as I'd like, but just as much as would be necessary to really both integrate new players, like when a guy comes in at the deadline, it usually takes a while to figure them out, and just to develop those guys during the season itself, so it puts a lot of the onus on the players' off-season regimen in summer league.
Oh, absolutely. I think you saw that with the Mavs when the Mavs traded for Rondo. I remember being stunned. It's like, wow, they are never practicing. They went like a month with like three practices at home. And it was like, well, how are they ever going to integrate this guy on their team? Never going to practice.
And it's even more egregious after the All-Star break because they generally condense it a little bit more. You see more back-to-back. It's concerning because, yeah, you don't have trouble with that. And to me, that really degrades getting a guy at the deadline, which isn't the worst thing in the world. I mean, that you don't have to prioritize that. But at the same point, I think it's also good from a rest perspective because also what you see, and part of the reason they have so few practices, is that the days they have off are often heavy travel days.
Yeah. And I think that's the one word I have when people say, oh, young guy, go to the NBA, get paid to develop. And that's true, but as you were saying, you got to be so self-motivated because you're not practicing, you're not playing. It's very easy to fall into negative habits. If you're used to playing all the time, all of a sudden, you're a millionaire, you play once a month, and you have no one to watch what you're doing, and you're a 19-year-old kid in a foreign city. But I think for me, the guy I'm curious to watch is Noah Vonleh, because I've been watching a lot of Indiana this year, and they are a really fun college team. And I'm watching them thinking, man, if Vonleh was still in college, he'd be a junior. Surrounded by future NBA players, he'd probably be a first-team All-Big Ten guy, first-team All-American, realistically. I mean, that's pretty plausible. He'd be considered top five, top 10 pick. So is he really better off these last 2 years playing limited minutes on teams trying to win? I don't know. I'm going to watch that for sure.
Yeah, it's hard to know offhand. I don't think college does a particularly good job developing guys either. I mean, you see a lot of guys. Actually, something that I think about is Festus Ezeli told me once that he picked up the game really late. I think he picked it up it was 14 or 16. I can't remember offhand. But his whole thing with that was that he was very pleased that it allowed him to not have developed any bad habits. And that's another aspect towards teaching big men, you know, developing that stuff a little bit later, is that if you kind of take that out of the young coach's hands, they hopefully you can kind of make it more of a blank slate when they get to a level, maybe when they're 16 or 17, where you could have something like a big man camp, where they can really even run by the NBA, which is actually the way I would do it, and just do best practices with those guys, give them, you know, because I think by 16, 17, you have a pretty good idea of who could be, you don't know for sure, but who could be a potential NBA big guy, and then you give them like 2 weeks every summer, and you say, here, talk to Shaq, talk to Olajuwon, talk to all these guys, and the NBA will pay them money to make it so these guys are a little bit better prepared for where this is going.
So I do think that those, some of those camps, I forget what it's called. I'm not sure if it's Team USA or like the NBA Players Association. They have like top 100 players. They come for a weekend and NBA players are there. That story reminded me a lot of Tim Duncan, obviously. Like Virgin Islands, he was a swimmer. The famous story about the hurricane. Well, I'm 16, I'll play basketball. He has no bad habits. And then you see from there, he's just the most fundamentally sound basketball player. One of the most athletes we've ever seen. Because he didn't develop any bad habits as a kid.
And that also might be true, I don't know it for sure, I'd love to ask him if I have the chance, of somebody like Anthony Davis who started as a guard. He probably didn't have many habits as a big man because he wasn't one.
That's true, I don't think about that, but that is true. That is very true.
So one of the things that you focused on more this year than I have is the college game, and I try to keep Real GM Radio more focused on the NBA, but who has really stuck out to you on the college level, ideally those that you're thinking of as a pro?
Well, I mean, I think you got to start, of course, with Simmons and Ingram. They're the two guys who really stood out this year. I think everyone kind of realizes this draft is not going to be 2015. It's one of the weaker drafts we've seen in a while. But those two guys have really kind of, really all see. I mean, Ingram started off slower. Simmons started off really strong. And we've seen kind of, they both had their games kind of picked apart in the last few weeks. And I still think those are, they're clearly the two top American players in this year's draft. And I would say, like, I would think Ingram, I would think would be one of the best. They'd both be top five-ish picks, I think, in most drafts. After that, though, there's definitely a pretty big drop-off.
Do you feel like a lot of Simmons' value is going to be derived from the offense going through him?
I mean, 100%, because he can't shoot, so he has to have the ball in his hands all the time. And that's the concern with Simmons. If you start, like, looking at, well, who could be drafting that high, it's like, whoa. Whoever drafts Simmons is going to have to make a lot of changes really fast to the roster. He's not the same kind of player as Jaleel, but the same kind of thing that the holes he has in his game are going to require very specific players around him to maximize what he can do well. Whereas with Ingram is just plug and play. I mean, he's much younger, he's much thinner, so he might not be as ready physically, but he's a great shooter, he's super long, can handle pass. He's a plug and play pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, and there are very different values. I mean, somebody with Simmons' talent, you can see the ceiling where, you know, if you can get something I've always keyed on is that if you can get somebody who can run your offense from a position other than point guard, that is an incredible value. And especially for him, if he can defend fours, that it would be a huge benefit too, because that's not a premium defensive position. So and that way, if he can really do that, then more of the forward defenders that we see in the league are of the 3-4 variety. You can think about Kawhi, Giannis, whoever. I mean, Giannis isn't even really at that level yet, but most of those guys are small forwards that can move up. So if that's what Simmons can do offensively, defensively, I think finding a complement at the three is a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of his defense, Simmons reminds me a lot of Blake Griffin in terms of, like, he's a super athlete, very well built, but he's kind of got short arms, and he's so used to playing offense. He's not necessarily locked in all that often on defense. But when he wants to, he can play some great defense. The game I was back to with Simmons is he went up against Henry Allenson, Marquette, earlier in the season, and that's the guy who's playing on the lottery, top 10, top 5 pick. And they were going 1-on-1 for 40 minutes, and that was really something to watch. And what happened was Simmons would press up an Allenson on the perimeter. He'd guard with the ball out of his hands. Allenson would post him up and shoot on the top of him because Simmons kind of had a short little wingspan. And that thing Simmons is, his arms are going to mean he cannot take plays off on defense, which he does all the time right now.
Is that a concern for you, or do you think, it's a teenage kid, he'll figure it out?
I think he should be able to, but you never know. That's something that probably comes down to interviews, knowing him as a person off on and off the court. He has the skills to be a good defender, but I don't think it'll come easy to him because of his length.
Is there a team or a situation that stands out to you with Simmons that you think would be a positive of, oh, that makes a lot of sense, or is it just kind of situationally?
I think I'm looking right now at like the kind of the top five-ish. I feel like the cliche answer is Boston. They pretty much created the perfect supporting cast for somebody to walk in there. And he would look great in Boston with Amir Johnson, all those wings around him who can shoot and play defense. I think what I've worried about with Simmons, a team like LA or Philly or Minnesota that has very little shooting, that I think would be a very, very big problem.
I think Minnesota would be fun because you would have to think about it in a different way than they are right now, which is the idea that if Simmons was as good as we hope, that he and Towns are your core. And then you have to, the other guys, you either make them work or you don't. And I know a lot of Minnesota fans don't like thinking about Wiggins that way. And of course, the only reason that you would ever do that is by getting somebody as good as Ben Simmons. But I guess you could make the same argument that if they had the choice, then Ingram is a better aligned. But if you could theoretically, let's say Simmons and Towns, if you could have them at the 4 and the 5, what you could do at the other three spots could just be revolutionary.
I see that, but I'm looking with them is imagine Ingram and Wiggins at 3 and 2. You got a 6'11" guy and a 6'8" guy who are super athletes with super long arms. He could just terrorize teams on defense. And then Ingram is the perfect guy for them because he spreads the floor. Because I feel like the worry is if you have Simmons and Rubio out there, Towns becomes a spot-up shooter, which is, you know, he can do it. But I want Karl Towns playing in the paint. I want Karl Towns attacking the basket. I want guys open the floor for Karl Towns. Like, Simmons' best skill is creating shots for somebody else. But Karl Towns does not need somebody creating shots for him, really. He can do it all by himself. So for me, I think Minnesota, I'll go Ingram for sure. And I'm just trying to imagine Ingram and Wiggins just absolutely just tear our teams on defense in the perimeter.
Yeah, and you could bounce them at the 2 and 3. You could also do them at the 3 and 4, depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, for sure.
And then you think about, so the two of them, I don't think necessarily Rubio is a mandatory part of their future if you get those two. But you could put as the third guy of that, you know, non-point guard, non-center rotation, as long as that guy can shoot, whatever his other strengths are, you can use it pretty well.
Yeah. Well, also with Minnesota, I've been kind of boning up on them recently. I really love this lineup they're going out, Rubio, Levine, Wiggins, Gorgie, Towns. That five, I think, works really, really well together. And I'm really curious how they do it the next month and a half.
I think Jang is doing a better job in those lineups than I thought he would. I wrote a kind of a rant piece about Minnesota and Sam Mitchell's rotations, and originally he was one of the concerning pieces. He wasn't the focus for me. That was more playing Levine next to Rubio and things like that, but Jang has done a nice job in that, and also I think that he is the most easily upgradable of those guys, because if Towns can be a self-sufficient five, then you could go in a lot of different directions of power forward, but right now, as they're kind of growing together, he does a nice job of filling in the gaps.
Yeah, that's one of the things I think where, like, playing with Towns makes your life so much easier. Playing with Towns, whatever your strengths are, he can accentuate them. Like, he's just... That's what makes I love his game so much, is because he makes everything around him so much better. Because whatever Jen can't do well, Towns can do. Whatever Wiggins can't do well, Towns can do. So he opens the floor for those guys. He gets them shots. He guards the perimeter for them. He protects the rim for them. And it's just, and Gordon's a smart player. He's got some good skills to him. And it works because he's got Towns there. So you're definitely right. He's probably the guy you could easily move the most out of.
A challenging question for you. If you were theoretically given the choice, and I'm not saying anybody would, let's ignore contracts to make this more fair. Would you be more comfortable building around Towns than Anthony Davis right now?
Yeah, I would. But I've been a Karl Towns truther for a long time. Like, I've been on the I was on the Karl Towns truther album last year. Not because I was comparing to Davis at 18. And I think Towns is a much bigger, better shooter, a better passer, and a better post player. Which, I mean, Davis is amazing, obviously, but I think Towns is just as amazing. I think he's a more versatile player. And when I'm building around a guy, I'm really looking for versatility. Because to me, like, you want to leave yourself as many outs as possible. Because you never really kind of, especially in the draft, you really can't control who comes to you. You just kind of have to hope players to work appear. So the more versatile a player is, the more type of players around them can work. And I think that's really the key to building a team. We'll all go back to Philly. When you draft Okafor, it's like, man, now you're locking this kind of player at the 4, this guy at the 3, this guy at the 2, this guy at the 1. Or you draft kind of like Towns, like, it's just a free-for-all, whoever's available.
And versatility is an interesting word, because I agree with you, and I think that it's kind of funny because he doesn't have positional versatility, but that's because he provides versatility of skill at the most valuable position if you can get a guy who is a quality defender.
Though I will say, I was kind of hoping to see him land in Philly and play with Embiid, or see him land in Sacramento and play with Cousins. That I would be kind of curious to see what would happen.
Yeah, we'll probably only get to see that in All-Star games. But I think that the best end game for Towns is to just be an evolutionary five that can play inside and outside, you know, kind of be what Duncan would be if he played, if he had developed and played now as opposed to when he came in. I mean, that isn't to say necessarily that he'll be as great as Duncan, first ballot Hall of Famer, best power forward of all time, all that kind of stuff, but he has the foundation that you can make those comparisons and not feel ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I see Towns and I look at the Warriors, I think, well, what if we put a 7-foot guy in Draymond Green's role? He could do most of the same things, but also be 7 feet tall. And then it's like, oh, man, that's a lot of depth for real.
Yeah, it is. And what I love about the other guys, Porzingis and Turner especially, is that they're great in different ways. They're not versatile. They're not as good as Towns. You know, they're going to be at a different level. But, like, Porzingis has a skill set that I've never seen for a guy that big. And, yeah, Dirk is amazing, and Dirk is a better player. But the way Porzingis, like, comes off screens is super weird for a guy his size.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, he is way ahead of Dirk at the same age. I mean, obviously I'm a Dallas guy, but fair is fair. He plays better defense than Dirk, even ahead of them. I don't think he'll be the type of scorer, type of shooter, but he's a great prospect. I'm curious to see how they're going to build it on him with no draft picks. That's, to me, is a huge question in the book right now.
It's going to take them time, and it's a little bit concerning just because that is a team that has never really done well with that, you know, with the idea that it's going to take time, but there isn't really a way they can do it. The way they could expedite it would involve trading Melo, but that, of course, requires his consent.
Well, here's a conspiracy theory. You want to get a guy pissed off, you let Kurt Rambis coach him for 2 months. That'll drive a player to decide anything, I imagine.
I love it. It's a challenge because, so you're in the spot where you want, where if he's going to stay around, you want him to be happy, and he's a good enough player that it's not like you're, he's not dead weight. Because if he was worse, then he would be kind of a sunk cost in a way, and you just have to deal with it. But he's still at the point where another team could be intrigued, but you need him to waive his no-trade clause. I mean, conceptually, to me, and Melo, I had him on my All-Star team for a reason. This isn't a guy who I'm not trashing him for this. But Porzingis is so special that, to me, if you're in New York, if you could conceptually get him to agree to a trade to a team where he basically went into space, despite that making the Knicks a worse team in the present, I think that would be a trade they should consider if it was possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's about finding guys around Porzingis and his age range who can grow with him together. You look at Towns in Minnesota, he's got 5 or 6 under 24 guys he can grow with.
And they're going to get another couple more.
Guys. Yeah, like in free agency, because, you know, RFAs, it's hard to get them. And no one's trying those guys anymore either. So you got to find guys for 26, 27, and they're still not really on Porzingis' timetable. And the only asset we have is Carmelo. He's the only guy who's going to get you draft picks, I think, off that roster.
Yeah, I don't. Galway's going to be a free agent this year, so they can't really move him for anything. And the other players, they have some guys that I like. I mean, eventually maybe Robin Lopez, because he's a good player. He's on a reasonable contract, but he's at the level where it's hard to see a team falling in love with him enough to really give up something of value. He's more a player that another team would be really happy to have than that you're going to be really having to beat teams off with a stick, which is what you want when you're going to get value.
I mean, absolutely. Like, Robin Lopez, I mean, he's a good NBA player, but there's a lot of centers out there. There's no one who's like, man, we're Robin Lopez away from being a great team.
Yeah, and I think that one of the other end games with this, Seth Partnow's written about this, a lot of people have, I think it's also just a part of where the league is going, is that maybe where these back-to-the-basket centers go is the second unit, because you can't, there isn't the defensive obligation a lot of times, especially if you're going unit against unit. And backup centers in this league cannot handle a Jahlil Okafor.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely, I've seen that kind of talk out there, and that does make a lot of sense. I think, to me, it's just more and more going not even in terms of, like, backups and starters. It's about, like, finding 3 or 4 minute combinations of players. And that's what I've noticed watching Rick Carlisle over the last 4 or 5 years. And people look, oh, man, what a wizard of a coach. What he does really, really well is he's constantly changing dynamic to attack very small weaknesses very, very quickly. I remember I was watching a game. It was Mavs versus Wolves. And Sam Mitchell was making a sub every, like, 5 or 6 minutes. He's bringing all the bench at once. Then it's like this. And Rick Carlisle is just a constant stream of subs. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. And he's throwing out, like, 5 or 6 looks right away really, really quickly. And he's like, you know what? That look does not work. Get it out of here. Next look right away. Try this. Then this, then this, then this. And that's where I think the little league is going.
And that also makes it really hard to adjust, because by the time you've kind of sorted things out, there's a different dynamic out there. And not every player is going to love that, and not every player is going to work with it. But if you get the right mentality of players and you have the right skill sets, it can happen.
Yeah, a lot of it, too, is just your coach being able to think on his feet really quickly. Like, there are some coaches, like, okay, you give them a day between games to adjust. Against someone like Rick Carlisle, you better be thinking every 2 minutes. You better be snap decisions.
Doc Rivers is a guy that I'm thinking of with that. Doc does a really good job managing personalities, but I don't see him as a guy who's good at making flash adjustments.
you saw that a lot too with, you know, obviously Scott Brooks is a classic example of that. And I think also something you learn from, like the example of that. I remember the first finals, Carlisle versus Spoelstra, and Carlisle really attacked Mike Bibby, and Spoelstra just told game six by bringing it to Brian Chalmers, and it's just, you learn a lesson from there. And that's part two of coaching, is they're just like players. They learn from their mistakes. The best ones do. The ones who, you know, are willing to swallow their ego, admit what happened, and learn from it.
What other college players have stood out to you so far?
Well, I guess in terms of, like, there's different levels of players. I think what I'm thinking this year is this draft reminds me of 2011. If you remember, that was the lockout year, and a lot of guys stayed in school. Like, there was, like, Jared Solinger, John Hansen. Was looking back on it, like, well, who cares? But at the time, it was a big deal. And everyone was like, wow, the top of this draft is not very good. It's a very elite draft. And it was. What happened, though, was the best players were 11 to 20, 20 to 30. Guys like Chandler Parsons. And from what I remember of that draft, the best players were later in the first round. And yeah. I guess the same thing happening here.
There are a lot of guys that I've seen in the limited amount that I've seen so far that I think could have a role on good teams. Then maybe they're not going to be the best player, the second best player, even the third best player. But if you can get cheap labor, especially, I've written about this for the Sporting News, you know, with this rookie scale, this is the last year for sure. I mean, it could end up changing it, but this is the last year we know definitely is going to be on this super team-friendly rookie scale. And so, yeah, maybe, you know, the first year you assume that a rookie's not going to be a positive contributor. That's just the way it generally works, especially if you take him 15 or later. But you're going to have them for a little over $1 million a year for the next 3 years after that. And if they're your sixth or your fifth man, that's awesome too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can throw you some guys. I'm looking at the Draft Express mock right now, later the first round to kind of stand out to me. I guess, like I think Denzel Valentine, that's the guy. He can go much higher. I mean, I'm imagining if Michigan State goes far in the tournament. But, man, that guy is a fun basketball player to watch. Like, I would recommend watch him play. He has his fingerprints all over the game. He is as dominant a college player that I've seen in a while. He's averaging right now 20 points, 7 boards, and 7 assists a game. And he's a 45% three-point shooter. He cannot be guarded at all at the college level. And he's not very fast. He can't move very well. I don't know if he'd be a plus defender, but he is such a great – he will be so great as a fifth option on a team or as a second-unit point guard. He will be freaking great at that. I look at him, I could see him being kind of like a better version of Evan Turner on a good team.
Yeah, I can see that. That definitely makes sense. A guy that I've been, I haven't watched a ton of Gonzaga this year, but I've always thought Sabonis when I've watched
him.
Oh, yeah. That he's not going to be the best player on your team, but if he's your fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth best guy, he'll be a lot of fun.
I got to see him up close. He came to SMU, and I was very, very impressed. The thing about him is he is really fast. He is really strong. He is really tough, and he is really skilled. The problem with him is he's got short arms and he can't shoot, but he can switch pick and rolls. He'll murder you in the post, and he fights. He really fights and competes for a guy 6'11", 230. He has great post moves. He can really pass the ball, too. I look at him, I think he'll be a phenomenal third big man on the team.
Yeah, second unit guy, but just rips people, and then maybe ends up getting overpaid on his second contract.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, I think, a lot of great fifth through seventh men in this draft. But, and who knows, we might have some upside from there. A guy I like a lot with upside would be Torian Prince at Baylor. What's happening with him, he's like a 6'7", 220 combo forward, shoots threes, can guard 3 or 4 positions, put on the floor. His problem is Baylor plays freaking zone all season. He never plays man defense, so you can't really see what he can do. That's a whole different can of worms, but Baylor should probably be playing zone defense when they have elite athletes at every position, but that's neither here nor there.
Do you have a feel on Scal yet?
Oh, man, Scal LeBissiere. Oof. My only feel on him is I hope he goes back to school. Like, I look at Scal. Scal's your classic small ball five. He's a really skinny guy, and there's no chance he can guard Andre Drummond or DeMarcus Cousins or Karl Towns or Brook Lopez or any of the more traditional fives. And he can't play four because he's a shot blocker, and he's not a great shooter. So he's a small ball five, spread, pick and roll, dive to the rim guy. The problem with that is there's a lot of guys like that. Like, I look at Scal, and I don't see any way better than Ivan Rabb at California. They're pretty much the same player, but Rabb is way more advanced on offense. He gets way more rebounds. And I guess the same thing probably with Devonta Davis at Michigan State, or you look at Shake Diallo. I put Scal more on level of Shake Diallo at Kansas, another guy who was thought of a lottery pick, but he should probably come back to school as a sophomore.
For selfish reasons, I hope that some of those guys come out and then just fall a little bit, and maybe they can get into some better situations, because with all of them, you're going to need, maybe except for Rab, you're going to need to be patient because it's going to take them some time to figure it out and, you know, to fill out as well. And I'm more comfortable seeing a guy do that in the pros, especially when they're making a little bit of money. But we'll see what decisions those guys make, because another part of this is that if there's a new CBA by 2017, then there will be presumably some changes to the rookie scale. We don't know exactly what it'll be, and it probably won't be that much better for them, but it almost definitely will be different. And even if it's like, let's say it's tied to the salary cap, it'd probably be more lucrative than what they're getting now.
Yeah, I think with those guys, though, like, those are very key developmental years. I would tell them, hey, man, the money will be there. You're freaking 6'11". You're freaking athletic. You got skills. Don't sweat the cash right now.
Like Cauley Stein.
Yeah, don't sweat the cash. The cash will be waiting for you when you're ready. I would say Rab, I think, is a guy I'm really, really curious to get to the NBA level. Because Cal has no spacing, really. They play Ty Wallace, who can't shoot. Jaylen Brown can't shoot. They play two bigs who can't shoot seven-footers. Rab, when I see them playing space, is super interesting. I comp them to, like, imagine Brandon Wright. If Brandon Wright had a great post game, it could handle the ball and pass the ball.
And had better instincts.
Yeah, I mean, Ivan Rabb is such a skilled basketball player. I think he could be possibly the steal of this draft.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with him because I've seen a couple of their games in person, and there are moments where you watch him and you go, wait, which one of those guys is the guy who's the highly touted prospect and which is the, like, late lottery pick? But then you kind of think, well, how is he going to work? You know, let's say he has to play the five in the pros. You know, he's going to struggle with some of those guys. But I think that something that gets lost in the shuffle sometimes is that there is a lot of value in the NBA for just being a rotation player. You know, let's say he can't start. Okay.
Yeah, as I was just saying earlier, it's like these days, you play in the right system, and he's in eight lineups. That's really what matters. It's not so much, oh, he's starting, he's a bench player. You look at, okay, he'll play with this guy for 5 minutes, he'll play with that guy for 4 minutes, play with that guy for 5 minutes. And they'll have this kind of team with that lineup, that kind of team with this lineup. And all add it all together, you've got a very impactful player.
Are you as bitter as I am that some of these most interesting players aren't even going to play in the NCAA tournament?
I mean, obviously Simmons. Let me look at this. Simmons not going to play in the tournament, but the Cal guys will be there. Dunn will be there. I think it's really only Ben Simmons, Henry Ellenson will play in the tournament. Those are really the only two guys who won't be there at the top 15 or 20. Everybody else will be there.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I just would have been fun to see Simmons against that competition.
That would have been fun, no doubt.
Yeah, that LSU team is just so inconsistent. It's maddening to watch them sometimes.
I mean, the crazy thing about it, they've got a lot of talent. They've got this guy, Tim Quarterman, a 6'6 guy, might be an NBA point guard. They've got Antonio Blackney, a 5-star recruit. They've got a pretty good big man in Craig Victor. I mean, they got no excuse. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. Well, and as you wrote, I think, was that last week about how much they're missing Jordan Mickey and Jarrell Martin? Like, if they had one of those guys to come back, that would have been the kind of the way for them to really make it.
Yeah, I mean, because I saw someone tweeting, like, man, LSU gained the number one player in the country, but they're so much worse. Like, yeah, they lost two really great college big men. And going back to, like, the small ball five discussion, why I love Mickey so much is, like, he is the small ball five because he's like 240. He's got super long arms, great athlete. So he can block shots, and he can bang in the post, and he can create offense off the dribble, and he can post up, and he has like a 20-foot jumper. Like, to me, if he come back to college and he can play with Simmons for a year in a pick and roll, we're looking at top 15 pick easily.
Yeah, and he, as a second-round pick, he doesn't have the same kind of money as if he had been a first, but at the same point, there's also less team control, so he'll become a free agent a little bit earlier, which is, I guess, a good thing for him. Do you think he'll be a five eventually? Is that kind of in the pros? Do you think that's what it'll be?
I think so. I mean, I think, as we were saying earlier, like, if a guy can play down a spot, you just got to do it. If a guy can be a good four and a great five, you got to play at the five. If he can survive at one position, I guess, let me say it. If a guy can survive at a position lower than he naturally would play, you got to move him there. Like, if he can, like Harrison Barnes is the classic example. He can survive as a four, it makes him so much more valuable than him being a guy at the three. And Mickey, he can survive with the five, that makes him so much more valuable because he's a faster player. He spreads the floor more, and it makes you a faster team in general with him at the five.
And if they can, you know, slide around for defensive purposes, all the better.
Yeah. And Mickey's a guy who can, I think, probably switch pick and rolls at the five position. So that's Money in the Bank right there.
And the other kind of amazing possibility, not with Mickey, but with, I'm thinking more with Towns, is I think we're going to see more of these bigs that get capable of running pick and rolls, which is just something that people don't really know what to deal with right now.
I mean, that's just the way, without repeating being into cliches, that's the way the league is going. Like, big men got to defend pick and rolls. That's the NBA game these days.
Yeah, like if
you bang the post, that's great. You just got to move your feet in the front, like, got to do it.
Yeah, but like if you're, let's say you're the Pelicans and you can run an Anthony Davis initiating a 4-2 pick and roll, teams just wouldn't be able to handle that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Mavs series last year, Mavs Rockets, and then it was close from that. They're like, oh man, let's just run the Josh Dwight pick and roll at Dirk every single time. And I won a series for them. That was it. There was just nothing the Mavs could do. It was dunk, 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 dunk. It was outrageous.
Yeah, it really is impressive. Anything else sting out to you want to talk about?
I don't know. I mean, I think for me, with the tournament, I would say, I guess we already talked about it, but like, watch Cal. Cal is, I think, the team to watch in this tournament. They've got possibly 3 to 5. I love Jabari Bird. I think he's an NBA player for sure, and he's just being hidden all the good players around him.
I like
him too.
They've
got 3 to 5 NBA players. If they can find the right mix, all those guys can make a lot of money really fast in March. That's the fun part about March Madness is like, man, you're talking about 40 minutes for like $10 million in your life right now. Just play one great game, get on the news, get your name out there. I mean, I remember, the one I remember is Kyle O'Quinn playing at Norfolk State. No one knew anything about this guy. The 15th seed, he played Missouri the 2 seed. He had the game of his life, and now what, he's a 5-year NBA player after that one game. That's what March Madness is all about, man. 40 minutes, change your whole freaking life.
And what I love about it is also, as somebody who's become more of an NBA fan with time, is the timing is perfect. If you're somebody who's more of an NBA person, you can watch the NCAA tournament, especially the opening weekend. It's not a big time in the professional schedule. And then you can downshift, you can get ready for NBA basketball. And then by the time it's over, that's when you have the draft. And as long as you can remember what you watched a couple months before, you're all good.
I mean, my goodness. Middle of March, early April in the NBA, that's a dead time. Guys are already resting, and maybe you have to race for the 7th or 8th seed, but nothing really too groundbreaking is happening. You catch 2 weeks of March Madness, April 4th you're done, then you get a week to get back to the playoffs, and boom, it's the playoffs.
Yeah. It's a pretty awesome world right now, and we'll see where it goes from here. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. It's always great to talk to you, man.
All right, man. Have a good one.
Thanks again to Jonathan Charks for taking the time to come on. You can read him at RealGM, patternofbasketball.blogspot.com, which is his site, and numerous other outlets. You can also follow him on Twitter. Very good follow. Jonathan Charks, JonathanTjarks. And I love talking to Jonathan and reading his work because he has a distinct perspective. I think he's right on a vast majority of things, and where the league is going is, I think, where he's most right. And the piece that we talked about early on with Jahlil Okafor and Nerlens Noel, I think, is a really good kind of testament to the way that he's thinking about it. And I think for the most part, he's right. I've criticized Nick Vucevic for such a long time that it's kind of second nature in that kind of a way. And I think there is a place for those tiny guys. It's just going to be a little bit different, and you have to be so good to make it work. So, Jonathan, I've believed it for a while, and I still believe it and will believe it for a long time. He's a rising star in this business. Keep an eye on him and follow him on Twitter if you don't already and read his work. He is one of the people of the group that I read everything that they put out, and it's worth it. And so if I'm doing that, you should probably be doing it too. So also, if you're going to be doing that, I encourage that. You should also definitely use SeatGeek. You can use the code REALGM, REALGM, all caps, no spaces, and that will get you $20 off your first purchase. It is a wonderful app, and I'm thrilled that they're a sponsor. And as I said during the live read, I am a big fan of their product. It's something that I'm very familiar with. So when that opportunity came across, I was absolutely pumped about it, I guess is probably the best word for it. So I've had a lot of material come out in the last little bit. I started what are going to be a series of 30 off-season previews for the sporting news. It started with the San Antonio Spurs. That came out on Wednesday, or maybe it was Tuesday. It was Tuesday. And I also did an AMA on Reddit, which was really, really fun. You should be able to see that on my Facebook page, which is Danny LaRue NBA. You can also follow me on Twitter at Danny LaRue, DannyLeroux. As I say pretty much every episode, I read everything. I respond to as much as I can. I am getting more now, so that makes it harder to respond. But I do appreciate it. And, you know, whether it's positive, whether it's negative, whatever it is, as long as it's constructive, if it's just like, your voice is bad or something like that, well, I mean, you could say it, I'm not going to stop you, but it's, that's not really helpful. But other than that, it is. And Jonathan, he and I've been thinking about having him on in the near future anyway, as I was kind of diagramming the next month or so. And somebody mentioned the AMA, and I said, you know, I said, hey, I might as well reach out to him now. We ended up making it work for this week, and I'm really happy to have him. I love talking with him. So hope you enjoyed this podcast. I'm going to keep going strong for the next few weeks, and we'll see where it goes. Some of you have already asked, and it looks like it is going to happen. I don't say my guess ahead of time, but we are going to try to do a Sam Vecenie, Mike Schmitz preview of the draft guys, probably right before the NCAA tournament. I like to do right before that. I've considered before the conference tournament too, but as an NBA kind of centered thing, I think you kind of want to put all the NCAA stuff in one episode. And so that's the tentative plan for right now. So thank you so much for listening.